Do you have sound and action camera? Take one. The Water Environment Committee will come to order. Welcome. It's Monday morning, and we have the Director of the Department of Agriculture, Phil Ward, to give us a presentation. Thank you for coming, Phil.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Madam Chair. Phil Ward with the Department of Agriculture. Sorry to be so slow this morning. I just was looking at my handouts here, and we may have two different versions going to you. So I'll try and sort that through as we work through it this morning. It looks like there's one of the versions of the handout that missed this top page is all. So the one I'm going to be working from should start with Senate Bill 1010, Oregon's Water Quality Management Program. And then there are a couple that start, why was Senate Bill 1010 developed? So I apologize for that. But I think we can work through that without a problem. Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Phil Ward. I'm the Director of the Department of Agriculture. Members, good morning. I was asked to come and just give you a brief synopsis regarding a piece of legislation that several of you are very familiar with. Certainly has become maybe better known around this building than in some senses I would have preferred it to over the last couple of years. But at any rate, I'm here to talk about Senate Bill 1010, which actually that was legislation from the 1993 session. And the law has just held on to that old handle. And this presentation is going to take off Representative Jensen on the material we presented in your committee, but it has some different material with it. At any rate, when the chair asked me to come and talk a little bit about this program, I think your intent, Madam Chair, was to give you a brief overview and kind of progress report of where we're at. And I know there were some things that when we talked in your office that you were interested in, so if you'll make sure that I catch those kind of things. In 1993, this legislature passed this piece of legislation, and the purpose was to establish within the Department of Agriculture the authority for the prevention and control of water pollution from agricultural lands. And there are several reasons that happened, and I'm going to move to this page right here where it says, why was Senate Bill 1010 developed? But essentially what the situation was, for many years our department had, in under an agreement with the Department of Environmental Quality, served as what they called the lead management agency for addressing water pollution from agricultural sources. And so we did this without any real statutory authority to regulate in this area. It was simply a voluntary effort on our part, working through local soil and water conservation districts in areas where there had been identified water pollution problems from agriculture to address those problems. And again, the way we did this mostly was through these local groups called soil and water conservation districts, who our department has a statutory relationship, and they're charged with working with farmers in conservation around the state. So we did this for quite a number of years until we came to a point where it became apparent through a number of legal actions that were underway through counsel from our colleagues at the Department of Environmental Quality that there was a hole in our program, and essentially that hole was that we did not have the ability to require anything to be done if indeed that needed to happen to address these issues. And so We, meaning the department, at that point in time when we were faced with this particular issue, went to the State Board of Agriculture and then to the agricultural groups with whom we worked regularly and asked that question, do you want the Department of Agriculture involved in this issue with the appropriate authority to be able to function in this issue, or do you want us to step back and allow other agencies, entities, the DEQ, to serve as the lead contact with the agricultural community along these lines? At that point in time, there was fairly widespread agreement that the Department of Agriculture needed to stay in this business, and the Senate Bill 1010 was passed in 1993. There are several characteristics to this bill in the way that we are administering it under this philosophy slide here that I'd like to touch on, because I think they're fairly significant. The kind of approach we are attempting to take with Senate Bill 1010 is what we call an outcomes-based or conditions-based approach. That is, any requirements that the department adopts under Senate Bill 1010 have to be based on outcomes that need to occur, that should be in place on the land, or conditions that should be in place on the land. Now, what does that mean? Essentially, the model we have in Oregon and around the country is what I would call a practices-based model. The Forest Practices Act is an example where you essentially require certain practices to be conducted by the landowner, and it's assumed that those practices are being conducted, then they're meeting the intent of the law and addressing what needs to be addressed. The approach that we've chosen to take under Senate Bill 1010 is to require certain conditions be met on the land and then let the landowner adopt what practices they see fit to meet those conditions. So, for example, one of the conditions might be there shall not be erosion beyond certain amounts. A number of the plans we have in place specify how much erosion should be occurring in these streamside areas. And so that might be a condition that the landowner would need to meet. That is probably the key, a key issue in terms of how we're administering Senate Bill 1010. The other things quickly, our approach is watershed-based. The Water Resources Department has identified 91 sub-basins in the state of Oregon. We've broken those down into about 40 planning units, aggregated some of those sub-basins. And this program has a large voluntary front end with a small regulatory backstop. And so the intent of this program is for farmers and ranchers to work together to address in a voluntary fashion these issues. But should there be issues we cannot get to through that voluntary approach, then there is a regulatory backstop based on the condition philosophy that I just tried to articulate with you. We've kind of touched on what is the outcomes-based approach slide, which was the next one there. Again, required conditions, not required practices. Flexibilities for landowner. Flexibility for landowners. We believe that provides flexibility for landowners. And in agriculture, when you have over 230 commercial crops in this state, we felt like it would never be advisable to dictate to farmers how they farm. So that's one of the reasons we've taken that particular approach. On the next page under process, the way the process works, as we move, essentially we are required by law to adopt plans and then rules to protect water quality on agricultural lands in these different basins. And so the first thing we do after we have identified a basin that we're going to work in is that we develop a local advisory committee. And their charge is to help create the plan and rule document. The plans are the big picture document, the strategy, how do we address water pollution from agricultural sources. The rules are a much narrower document, and they identify the prohibited conditions that I referenced earlier.
Madam Chair.
Representative Morgan.
Going back to the point, Director Ward, about the local advisory committees, is there a standard procedure throughout the state for those committees being appointed?
Madam Chair, there is. And if I'll just touch on a bit of it briefly. Essentially, we go to the Soil and Water Conservation District in a local community, and we solicit recommendations from them. We also go to the local Farm Bureau chapter, the other agricultural organizations. Generally, we touch base with, as the process is beginning, with the county court as well. So there is a fairly well-defined process there, but essentially we ask that the local Soil and Water District be the funnel for providing us a list of recommended names, and then those names come to the State Board of Agriculture, they review them, and then ultimately I appoint them once the list has been settled.
May I have a follow-up?
Sure.
What is the attempt to recruit a broad-based group? I mean, are you wanting everyone to be from agriculture, or are you looking for people in other areas, too?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. The law is pretty specific about the membership on this local advisory committee. The law actually says that there has to be a majority of landowners on the committee, and then it allows for some representation from, I think, what the rules refer to as public members. It could be environmental group representatives, those kind of things, agency members. I think the key component is that we're required to have a majority of landowners on these local advisory committees.
Thank you.
And I have a question as well. Is there a specified number in statute of how many are on the committee?
Madam Chair, there is not a specified number in statute that I can recollect.
Thank you. Continue.
The current status on this in this program, of Oregon's 91 sub-basins, we have broken that down into 41, what we call, or into 40 Senate Bill 1010 planning areas. There are currently 8 plans with rules adopted. And again, the way that works is that those come to the, they come from the local committee, they go to hearing, then they come back to the State Board of Agriculture, and ultimately to me for the final signature. And so there are 8 of those currently adopted around the state. 7 are in the hearing or adoption stage. The State Board of Agriculture will be considering a couple at its meeting in March. Currently, there are 11 committees meeting and 7 committees forming. 7 committees are planned to form in the year that we're currently in through 2002. Well, what is
Representative Jesse?
Do you have someplace available for us a breakdown down on who and where as far as these 7, 8, 11, 7, 7s are concerned?
Madam Chair, Representative, I do. And as I got away this morning, the printer stopped at 4 copies, so I would be happy to provide these 4 copies to you if I might.
I think our budget will allow some more copies to be made.
I will be happy to get those to you, and I apologize for the defugality this morning.
May I have a follow-up, Madam Chair?
That's fine. I just want to...
Representative Morgan.
So the goal here is that after the process is finished, end up with 91 plans?
Madam Chair, Representative, the goal is that we will end up with 40. We've taken those 91 sub-bases, and we've aggregated a few of them. So our goal is to come up with 40 plans.
And what's the timeline for having the whole program be completed?
Well, our hope is to have things done. I'm trying to remember my years here, but we had originally said when we began the Oregon plan that we'd planned out a strategy for 4 years doing this. This is going to take us a little longer, and we're actually going to be around 6 years. So we're going to be into 2002 probably before we get this finished.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, if you got a look at the map, the ones in blue are where things are identified. The Tualatin Basin up in northwest Oregon was the first basin that we completed. And then Bear Creek, way down in Medford, was the second one. Then we've also completed the North Coast Basin, again up in the northwest part of the state. The Lower Deschutes in the Columbia Basin area there has been adopted, the Umatilla and the Upper Grand Ronde. The board will be considering the Malheur at its next meeting in early March, and Wallowa County is out for hearing right now. So there's a fair amount of work going on around the state.
So Phil, could I ask, so is the idea that each area will have different needs and so they will plan for their own needs?
Madam Chair, that's exactly the idea. There's, we believe very strongly that Oregon's a diverse place geographically and agriculturally specifically. And so, obviously, it would have been a lot easier for the department to do one big statewide agricultural water quality plan. It would have saved us a lot of time, a lot of money, and probably a lot of trouble as well. But at any rate, we felt strongly, and as we initiated this process, as did the Board of Agriculture, that there needed to be site-specific plans for different basins around the state. And so that's the approach we've taken.
Representative King.
Thank you. The reduction in nitrogen and the Tualatin, can you just give a brief thumbnail of some improvement there that's, I haven't seen much in the literature in terms of what's happened there? And
Madam Chair, Representative, I did not bring a detailed workup on that, but we could provide some of that. We actually have seen in the Tualatin Basin decreases in both phosphorus and nitrogen levels, and improvement in the dissolved oxygen quantities in agricultural tributaries. We have seen some measurable improvements along those lines. Those are the kind of things that we're looking for.
I guess I'd like to see.
You'd like to see some more data on that, Madam Chair, Representative. We can sure have someone put some of that material together.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple questions. When were the rules adopted for the MQA?
Madam Chair, Representative Cruz, about 2 weeks ago, if my recollection
okay.
is correct.
I just wanted to see if it was after all the public hearings were done.
It was very recently.
Very recently.
Okay.
Very recent.
And my second question, Madam Chair, is, I understand the need for the separation of Bear Creek initially because it's such an urban population, but would there be a plan at some point in time for that to be integrated into the road plan, or is that going to continue to be a standalone?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think our staff felt when they were working this out that Bear Creek was unique. That
okay.
there was a very, it was a unique drainage, and that's why you see that as rather a small planning area.
Well, small planning area. But it's from Immigrant Lake clear down to the Rogue, so it certainly has a major impact on the Rogue system.
They're definitely working on the Inland Rogue right now, and I think the work in that's designed to be integrated with the work that was done in Bear Creek.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Jensen.
Just a very quick question there. I see that just a two or three small areas around the state where there's nothing scheduled. Can you explain why that is? One is over, would appear to be on the Idaho border, and a couple on the Warm Springs, off the Warm Springs Reservation.
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, certainly on the Indian reservations, we don't have the authority to work, and so we will not be doing that.
These aren't on the reservation. They appear to be off the reservation.
So there may be, I'm not certain. I'm not certain, Representative. I'd be speculating here, but I'll check that out, and we'll get some information for you.
What about the one over on the Snake River?
This real small one down here in the bottom?
No.
Hell's Canyon.
Hell's Canyon area.
And that is probably the federal lands. Issue, but again, I'm kind of talking through my hat here. I can recollect very vaguely some discussions about that, but I had better
okay.
I'd better get you some better documentation.
Representative Cruz.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I realize the political problems with dealing with tribal lands here, but we make extraordinary efforts to be collaborative and cooperative with them when we're doing all other things, natural resource. You know, have they been approached about being part of this and just decided not to, or are we just kind of carved them out?
Madam Chair, Representative, I know the tribes have been involved in several of our planning processes. My guess, it's simply a matter of authority for the actual adoption of State of Oregon rules. But again, I've given you more than I know off the top of my head right this morning. So,
thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Monette Sanders.
Madam Chair, thank you. I have a question regarding process. The plans are done, but then the practices are followed or tried to be observed by the landowners. Then who actually does the monitoring? Is that staff from the Department of Ag or?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's happened in a couple ways. In the place where we have the most history right now is in the Tualatin. The plan's been in place several years there. And frankly, it's our intent to use the local Soil and Water Conservation District to the greatest extent possible for implementation. There's a couple reasons there. One is that we don't, and I don't foresee us ever having enough staff for us to effectively implement 40 plans around the state. And there are 45 Soil and Water Conservation Districts, and we have a long history of working with them. Secondly, you know, again, in our experience, that local people respond to local people better. Now, I would qualify with that by saying, when we have, in terms of if a need for enforcement action arises, then the department would be involved with that. And there has never been a civil penalty issued under this law to this date. But there have been a number of what we call water quality advisory letters, where the local Soil and Water District has referred a situation to us and said, we believe that there's a violation of things going on here, and we'd like you to visit with this landowner and document it or not. And so we have done some situations like that and have been, thankfully, able to resolve the issues through that venue, so it's worked pretty well. But our hope is for these folks, the local soil and water folks, to be the primary implementers. And again, we serve as the backup, the technical help. And then, if a need for regulatory action does at some point arise, then our staff will be involved with that.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay, I think we're about through, and Rep. King has touched on a couple of things in the what has resulted slide. the neatest thing that's resulted, in my view, is that we've just seen a continuation and enhancement of the voluntary efforts going on by farmers and ranchers around the state. And there has been tremendous work done in recent years from farmers and ranchers on their own places to address some of these concerns because they think it's the right thing to do. And again, the representative mentioned the bullet there on water quality improvements in the Tualatin, and I'll be providing you some further information on that. And then, as we just touched on in our last conversation, the water quality advisory letters, and that's the tool that's been used in terms of regulation at this point. Again, we have not issued any penalties, but we have issued some advisories, and the landowners in those situations have addressed the issues of concern. Again, there are further anticipated benefits, reduced sediment loads, nutrient and bacteria load reductions. We hope to continue to see improved stream bank stability, riparian condition, and perhaps even some temperature improvements. On the last page, there are several issues I wanted to touch on just briefly, if I might. So you know some of the things that we've been dealing with from that end. There are some federal agencies that have expressed reservations about the outcomes-based approach that we talked about earlier. And again, the models around the country have been more practices-oriented, and so we have had some reservations expressed about this outcomes or conditions-based approach, and we're continuing to work through that. And I think ultimately we have to prove it works, and that's our job. If it doesn't, then we have to make the necessary adjustments, but we're really committed to work in that direction today.
Can you tell me which federal agencies those are?
Well, both the National Marine Fisheries Service, Madam Chair, and the Environmental Protection Agency did appear at the State Board of Agriculture some months ago and expressed some concerns along these lines.
Thank you.
And some of you are very, very well of this next issue as well. There have been landowner concerns about new regulation, and I think we all understand that, and I do not in any way want to minimize those concerns. What I would say to you is that we are very committed to making this a program that works for the landowners and not just for the bureaucracy. Frankly, the outcomes-based approach is a more difficult approach. From an agency standpoint, it would be a lot easier for to provide some directives in terms of this is how you do something, rather than this is the condition you got to meet. But again, we believe very strongly that if agriculture in Oregon is so diverse and so unique, that practices-based approach may not fit real well. So that's why we're trying this particular direction to give folks the flexibility to design their own program. And it does take time to see results. We're starting to see some of those now. We're encouraged about them, but monitoring is important, and we've talked about this with some of you in the past. And our budget will have a small package. The governor's budget for us has a small package in it to start building a better monitoring program than we've had in the past.
Representative Morgan.
Just to go back briefly to the bullet point about the landowner concerns, Representative Cruz and I spent a great deal of time in the interim working on this because the Umpqua plan was one of those that kind of got bogged down in that aspect. And I think that the Department of Ag really bent over backwards to make the process more responsive to landowners. We essentially got a second run at writing a plan down in that area, and it was very gratifying to work with the department, knowing the constraints that you're up against from the federal side of the equation. And it also would be interesting for the committee to know that there have been several pieces of legislation introduced into this session that attempt to deal with some of the issues that were raised by the landowner. And they've all been kind of clumped together and put in Senator Meserle's committee over on the Senate side to be worked over. And the intent is to raise the confidence that landowners have that their property rights are going to be protected in the process, but not to diminish the strength of that firewall that we're trying to build between the federal agency and the individual landowners. So that's kind of the ground that we're trying to work in there, and I think there's a lot of us that have interest in those bills as they work their way through the process. And another aspect that came to light during the development of the Umpqua plan was the need for monitoring and the fact that there are a lot of questions being asked by landowners about why they're being forced to take part in this program when there isn't really any apparent data that shows that the water quality is degraded. And so monitoring becomes a really important aspect of figuring out whether what you're doing is getting you the results that you think it is, and trying to kind of define where the goalposts are and when you're going to be able to say that you've been successful. So that is something that we kind of took a bit of time this interim to work over, but it's a very complex area that is going to take some time to work through.
Representative Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple questions, Phil. This ad package for monitoring, what does that look like?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it currently looks like just a single position to begin to design a comprehensive monitoring program around the state, and our hope is then to implement that, find resources, federal or other, to begin to implement that through our soil and water districts around the state.
Okay, follow up. For most of the at the project level for the Oregon plan, monitoring certainly is almost always a component part of that, and I know monitoring is addressed in most of the basin plans for TNT. So I guess part of my question is, rather than redesigning something that's been put in plan, maybe where we should be going is to have field folks that can actually do the monitoring and coordinate it at the local level.
Madam Chair, Representative Cruz, excuse me. I don't want to imply that there's not monitoring activity underway, because there is. And also in a regime where there were more resources available than we're dealing with right now, I think you would have seen a much more comprehensive package from the governor on this issue. The fact is that we're dealing with a kind of a scarce resource regime, and so we're trying to get the first piece in place where we can get someone on board and where we can figure out just what is going on out there monitoring wise and try and get a more coordinated effort together and begin to design a thoughtful and coordinated monitoring package that works all the way around our different planning areas.
Two more. Is EPA more concerned? I mean, I know EPA is concerned with clean water compliance. Has Safe Drinking Water Act also come into play and their concerns about this process?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't recall specific conversations about that issue with EPA. It may be, but I don't recall it.
And just one more follow-up, more a comment, Madam Chair, on this monitoring aspect. When we're, you know, we've got to focus on it here in 1010. We've got to focus on it, the Oregon plan, and it needs to be pretty collaborative. I think if we put combined resources, we may be able to get to what we truly need, which is basin level monitoring, so we can show. I mean, if this is results based here, and we need to start showing results sooner rather than later, so maybe that's the direction we ought to be focusing.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. Any questions, Representative Morgan?
More just a comment on Representative Cruz's comment that the monitoring issue, like you were saying, is fairly complicated because you're building in Oregon plan needs and 303D needs and TMDL needs and crossing over a lot of different agencies. And then you've got to throw in there the need for confidentiality for the landowners, and it becomes a real complex situation. But definitely somewhere that there is a lot of potential for movement in that direction. And we kind of, in several discussions that I've had with landowners in the Umpqua Basin, it becomes real clear that if a landowner is thrown into a situation where he's in court defending himself, he's going to be in a much better position with a bunch of data sets that show where he's at rather than the rules to the agricultural plan to show where he's at.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, just a couple things to close. And I just want to touch on a couple points here that the conversation has prompted me with. One, again, the design of the 10-10 program is that if it's truly an outcomes or conditions-based approach, then if you don't have a prohibited condition occurring on your land, then you're not going to have trouble with the State Department of Agriculture. And that, to me, is one of the unique components here, is that unless there are things going on that the agency is able to document as violating the prohibited condition, then the landowner faces no repercussions. Different perhaps than a practices-based approach where you have to put the practice in place whether you have an issue or not. And so I think that gives us some safety in terms of the monitoring issue, because we're not going to be requiring people that where there aren't problems to make changes. And again, that's one of the reasons that we took this approach. The other thing I just would like to mention quickly is that I have tremendous admiration for the folks on these local advisory committees, and particularly the folks in Umpqua. Representative Cruz's father chaired that committee, and that was tough duty. That was tough duty, and did a great job. And that committee stuck with us, circled back. We essentially took after landowner concerns first arose, we essentially took nearly a year time out and circled back and walked through it again and made some modifications in the plan and the rules to address those concerns. But these local folks that have served on these committees, if I had to pick a committee in the Umpqua tomorrow, I'd pick the same folks we picked before. Top folks who really care about their communities and spend a lot of time. The last thing I'd say is that I believe, and I guess you can say it comes with the turf being in the job I'm in, but I believe it's important to stay the course in this effort right now. There are a number of bills in that would significantly modify this program. I think there are some tune-up work we can do, and we will be working closely with all of you to get there. But the department will not be able to support significant modifications of this legislation. There are a number of reasons for that. We've touched upon it, but I think the most important is that we have an opportunity truly to make a truly Oregon approach to give it a chance to work. And we would want to make the case that we think there's still we still ought to stay the course. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the time with you this morning.
Well, thank you, Mr. Ware. I think that was a very interesting and informative report that you prepared. And I want to congratulate the Department of Agriculture for your approach, giving technical help to landowners and your idea of advisory letters to people. I think there are other agencies I'd like to see take the advisory letter approach before fines are levied. So I think you're doing good work, and we appreciate you being with us.
Thank you very much.
May I just add one thing?
Sure.
I received in the mail, I don't know, a few weeks ago, your latest newsletter publication, that tabloid that you send out, had a great overview in it of all the departments within the agency and who the people are and what they do. And it would probably be a valuable thing if the members of this committee were given a copy of that.
Madam Chair, we'd be happy to provide that.
Thank you. Okay. Doug Myers is here with Water Watch. He'll be giving us a presentation. And also Karen Russell.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am Doug Myers, and I'm here representing Water Watch. Last week, Water Watch made a presentation on the Oregon plan to Representative Jensen's Stream Restoration Committee, and had Kimberly Priestley with me then. Introduced her as one of the brains of the outfit, and I'd like to introduce another brain of the outfit, Karen Russell, who's a senior staff attorney. Karen.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to come today and talk about Water Watch and what we do. Starting with the basics, we're a nonprofit river conservation group dedicated to promoting water policies and laws for Oregon that provide enough water in Oregon's rivers for fish and wildlife, clean water, and recreation for all Oregonians. We have about 800 members statewide in every legislative district in the state. And we're the only organization in Oregon that is dedicated exclusively to water policy and water flow issues in the state. We have a staff of 6 full-time people and 2 part-time people, a budget of approximately $475,000 yearly annual budget. And we have our main office in Portland with a field office in Medford. We were founded in 1985 by a passionate fly fisher named Tom Simmons, who was in the late 1970s involved with the Rogue Fly Fishers organization. And he worked on a number of passage improvement projects in the Rogue Basin. And as he was working on those projects, he found that the benefits of those projects were limited, because there were many spawning tributaries that weren't getting the water they needed for the fish that they were passing through these projects. And he started to look into what was happening and discovered that it was legal to dry up critical spawning tributaries in the Rogue and elsewhere in the state because of an old system relating to how we manage our water resources in the state, a system that is over a century old. And so Tom began to make trips to Salem, working as a citizen activist to try to push for water policy reform. And that is where he met his future wife and I guess business partner, Audrey Simmons, who at that time was working for the League, the Oregon League of Women Voters. And together they developed Water Watch. Water Watch was born, I like to say. A state-based group dedicated to the difficult task of water law reform. And over the years, we've become a model for similar organizations in Washington, Colorado, Montana, and probably also in Wyoming and Utah. So our original focus when we began was the legislative process. And in 1987, in part because of Water Watch's efforts, we saw the first act, piece of legislation that allows for the state to have water rights to keep water in stream. And there were some unique there was a unique water conservation bill that passed. And then when I came on board in the 1990s, we focused our efforts or broadened our efforts to include the State Water Resources Commission and the State Water Resources Department, the agency that is responsible for managing water in Oregon. And we also look at Bureau of Reclamation actions, because the Bureau has about 15 water projects in the state of Oregon. Most people in Oregon know little about the laws and policies governing how we manage our rivers. And most people don't know that the statutes say that the public owns the water. Mm-hmm. But I think that most people in Oregon, if not everyone, care about rivers. They care about fish, they care about clean water, and they care about rivers and how they are part of the special place that Oregon is, and they care about future generations. And Water Watch, when we appear before the legislative body and state and federal agencies, advocates for those values. And we try to educate and inform and advocate on these issues. And we also try to help people who are concerned about rivers have a meaningful say in the water process. I want to talk very briefly about the problem that we are trying to address, and then I'll also talk about two bills that we have coming forward this session. Oregon's rivers are facing a crisis. They are running dry in many areas of the state. All across Oregon, many rivers are chronically dried up or reduced to a trickle, especially in the summer months, creating severe problems for water quality, recreation, fish, and wildlife. And the state has recognized this problem in their strategic plan for 1999 to 2001. Their plan says, across Oregon, many streams are dry in the summer and fall months. Put very simply, there is not enough water where it is needed, when it is needed, to satisfy both existing and future water uses. This situation jeopardizes the high level of livability the Oregonians enjoy. It seriously limits the ability of Oregon's economy to grow and threatens existing users, water supplies, and sustainability of the natural systems which our economy relies upon. While low flows are natural to some extent, very often the problem is caused or aggravated by water withdrawals by agriculture, cities, businesses, other users of the water. And Water Watch has done a report to try to document this problem, and in the packet that we handed out, that report is kind of attached to the back. This report highlights 10 rivers in Oregon, and it, we believe, represents the serious chronic low flow problem that is facing many rivers in Oregon. Oregon's Progress Board has also, in its State of the of Oregon's Environment report, recognized excessive water withdrawals as a major environmental challenge for the state. So dry rivers are a problem for endangered fish, as any school child can tell you, fish need water to survive. And a watershed is not healthy if it is bled dry. So we, part of our program is pushing.
May I interrupt? What is Water Watch's position on water impoundments?
Chair Close, Representative Morgan, on storage projects?
Well, if the issue is that the water has been over-appropriated and that there are a number of river systems mm-hmm. or stream systems where the appropriation exceeds the ability, the water that's available, do you see putting in water impoundments, ponds and dams and things like that as a solution to that?
Not in every case, but it depends on the individual watershed and also how those impoundments are operated. In some areas, they can be used as a way to augment summer flows that are critical for fish and wildlife. Unfortunately, historically, we've operated impoundments pretty much for just taking water out of stream, and the Deschutes is kind of an example of that. But if we can be looking at multi-purpose storage, which is something that we've supported in the past, storage can be an alternative that would work, not necessarily in every basin.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I may, Karen. Let me give you an example that Reed Benson, the Executive Director of Water Watch, uses. Let's say you're a fiscal conservative and a state representative and chair of a natural resource subcommittee of Ways and Means, and some agency comes before you and says, we really need money, and here's this, what you would do, and I have a feeling that that this hypothetical example would do, you wouldn't immediately just say, here's the money. You would look for ways to do things within that agency and maybe take some of the other agencies or the Measure 66 funds, and you would do everything in your power just not to raise taxes to pay for that. And Water Watch feels the same way about dams. You look for ways to conserve. You look for lots of things to do. And people in that basin where there is a water shortage and where they want to grow, you measure and report. Representative Jensen's district is one of the fastest growing areas in Oregon, and people there measure and report their water use. And so far there's been enough to go around. And so there are things you do before you automatically build a dam to get water in the stream.
Mr. Mayor, if there's gigantic floods like we had in 97, then do theoretically would these people get a rebate back on their taxes that they paid on water?
Madam Chair, what water, you know, people who use water don't pay for it in Oregon.
If they did.
Well, we don't even want to mention that, frankly. We're not advocating any scheme to tax people for water use. People who live in cities like me think that we do pay for water use, but the city of Salem, where I live, doesn't pay anything for taking that water out. Now, they pay a lot, of course, for treatment and transportation and all the rest of it, and I help pay a little bit of that. But so far, anybody who takes water out of a stream for farming or municipal use or industrial use doesn't pay for that water at all.
Continue. Our report, as we call it, our Dry Rivers Report, contains recommendations on how to address the stream flow problem, and it includes some suggestions such as what Doug was talking about, water conservation, eliminating waste, providing dollars, purchase water to put in stream, willing buyer, willing seller type transactions, and also recommendations for actually changing the system, the water allocation system in Oregon, to try to bring about a balance between water remaining in stream for public uses and out of stream uses. But this session, what we are bringing forward are two common sense proposals. The first is measurement of water use, and the second is geared at making sure that all new users of groundwater go through the water permitting requirements, the water permitting statutes. First on measurement, what our bill would do is to require all water users in the state to have measuring devices in place within the next 5 years. Measurement, we believe, is just a common sense tool to try to getting a handle on the issues that are facing water users and the state and river advocates in Oregon. We don't know in many basins where water is going, when and how much. And so to try to get a handle on where we can tighten up the system and where we can bring about creative solutions to water shortages for water users and for streams, we need this basic monitoring tool. We believe it gives, it kind of adds a science to how we're trying to address this problem. And also, we think it can increase stream flows. We did a report on the Wood River, which is in the Klamath Basin, where the Water Resources Department had required measuring devices on diversions. And basically, as a result of the measurement, people were realizing that they were using more than what they were legally entitled to, and cutting back on their water use, and we documented an increase in stream flows of about 30 cubic feet per second, which is a pretty large amount of water. So measurement, while that may not happen in every basin in the state, it is an example where just measuring water use may result in an increase in stream flows, which is part of what Water Watch is advocating for.
Madam Chair?
Representative Cruz.
Yeah. What's Water Watch's position on unfunded mandates?
Madam Chair, Representative Cruz, in terms of water measurement?
Well, I mean, we have prohibitions against unfunded mandates from the state to other levels of government, but we don't necessarily have a position on unfunded mandates to the public or to private citizens, which to a degree this would be.
Well, we look at it as water users use the water without paying any money or for the privilege of using the water. And so part of the cost of doing business and using the water would be to measure your water use. Measurement can be as much as a couple hundred dollars to a couple thousand dollars. So it may not be that expensive, but it's such a basic tool that we believe it should be part and parcel of the privilege of using the water. And the other thing is we don't have, or we've supported in the past, concepts where there can be money and funding available and technical assistance available to help people measure their water use. So we don't oppose people getting help in providing measurement. But we think that first and foremost, the water user who is benefiting from the use should do of measuring, since the state, the cost of the state installing measuring devices would be very huge.
And I guess, Madam Chair, just a short follow-up, you know, things that are for the public benefit, I think, fall into the public realm to fund, that we can have this discussion at a later point.
Again, if I may, Madam Chair and Representative Cruz, one of my other clients is Trout Unlimited, and we're somewhat involved in the fish screen issue, and it's kind of been a topic of some discussion within Water Watch as to the wisdom of the state and Representative Morgan of getting into cost share for helping some of the larger folks who would have indeed. So we have discussed that, and I have reached no conclusion.
Okay, and I guess one more follow-up. You know, the larger folks, certainly the ability to cover that is one thing, but when you getting down to some folks who are kind of marginal in their ability to stay in business, additional costs become problematic at that point, and I guess I wouldn't be wanting to put small farmers out of business by requiring, and not necessarily that it would, but the concept of what we put on these folks and expect them to cover the costs of their ability to pay certainly needs to be taken into consideration.
And Madam Chair, I know better than to get into who gets the last word here with Representative Cruz, but Water Watch really believes that how in the world can you manage a basin? Only so much water is available. Population is growing. How in the world can you manage a basin without knowing who is using what and where?
I'll let you get the last word.
Continue. The second bill concept would require all new uses of groundwater to go through the existing water permitting statutes. And what the bill would do is eliminate a provision currently in law that exempts certain small uses of groundwater from the permitting requirements. One of the types of uses that's subject to these exemptions is group domestic or domestic uses, which currently are allowed 15,000 gallons per day for use without having to go through the permitting statute, which is really a pretty excessive amount of water just for domestic use. So we don't know the exact number of exempt wells out there. It could be anywhere from 200 to 225,000. And actually, I want to point out there's a typo in my testimony. I have 200 to 250,000. That's incorrect. But it's a large number of already existing exempt wells. And while individually they may be a very small amount of water, cumulatively they add up. And in basins, which are most of the basins in the state where groundwater is connected to or feeds surface water, we're concerned about the effect that it has on surface water stream flows. So this bill would not affect existing exempt uses. It would.
We're not hearing bills at this point, so if you could direct your testimony to your overall objective.
Okay, so that is one of the bills to try to get at a handle on stream flows. So I just wanted to close with a story of my son David, which Representative Jensen has heard before, but I love this story.
Madam Chair. So does Representative Jensen. I have great admiration for her son.
About a year ago, he and I were having an argument about whether or not he could go to school naked, and I told him no. And so he stomped out of the room, and a couple minutes later, I heard the toilet flush. And I heard it flush again and again and again. And about the fourth time, I went into the bathroom, and there he was standing there with his hand on the handle. And I said, David, what are you doing? He said, I'm mad at you, and I don't want the fish to have water. And I thought my son, who's all of 3 years old, was connecting his action as it related to water to the effect on rivers. And so I just wanted to close with a thought that while you may not agree with everything that Water Watch advocates for this session, just when you're considering water bills, think of my son and think of him with his hand on the handle. And maybe it helps interject some humor into an issue that is very near and dear to my heart. But think about how your decision will affect Oregon rivers. And we have three questions that we hope you'll ask. One is, will this bill protect stream flows or make it more likely that water will remain in stream for Oregon and for future generations? If it allows for more water use, is it requiring water users to be accountable for how they're using this public resource? And the third is, does it allow for public participation, for the public to be weighing in and having a say on how the public resource is being allocated? And if you answer yes to all three of those questions, we would urge you to support the bill. And I want to thank you very much for letting us be before you today.
Thank you. Question?
No, just a comment. It would seem to me that your son was actually returning water to the stream.
I didn't tell him that. You probably had to pay for it, right?
Yeah. The old water bill.
Madam Chair, if I could, just one very short question. Karen, you indicated and appreciated that what your annual budget was. But could you break your revenue source down for us? Is it primarily from membership? Is it from grants or other things of that sort?
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, I am not sure of the actual percentages. I think we are mostly foundation funded, but our membership is growing, and I want to say it's 20% of our annual budget, but I can check and get you accurate figures on that.
Just ballpark figures is fine. That'd be fine. Thank you.
And a follow-up to that, what is your major foundation that funds you?
I don't know the answer to that. I can get you that information.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Okay, committee. We have a committee bill that we would like to discuss. We're going to open a work session on introduction of this committee bill.
Madam Chair, I move that LC 1627 be introduced as a committee bill.
Okay, Representative Morgan has moved LC 1627, which you have a copy of in front of you, that it be introduced as a committee bill. Before we go to discussion, we'll have the staff read the description.
This draft, if put into a bill, would extend the temporary schedule for monthly hazardous waste management fees until December 31st, 2004. And the situation is there's several Oregon steel rolling mills that produce emission control dust, and during their happens during their manufacturing process, and the hazardous waste management facility, which is operated in Oregon by Chemical Waste Management of the Northwest, is authorized to manage and dispose of this type of waste. But recently, the steel rolling mills have been disposing that waste outside of Oregon because of the management fee imposed in our statute. So, and they've been going over the border to Idaho, which is cheaper for them. And so this bill will just set the fee in regards to what Idaho's legislature does. We're waiting to see the proponents of the bill, waiting to see Idaho gets out before we do, and then they'll amend the bill to determine what the fee should be so it's reasonable for people to stay within Oregon to dispose of the fee.
Dave Barrels is not here. This is something he is advocating. It's a situation where we're changing dates, trying to make it so they don't have to call the item. That's the situation. Is there discussion?
I have a question.
Jim King.
I'd like to know the meaning of a repeal's temporary fee schedule. Does that mean that they're looking to eliminate a fee, or are they eliminating the temporary aspect of the fee but retaining the fee?
The idea is to... That's an interesting question. It's been explained to me that we would be adjusting the fee. But the way this is written, it looks like we're just adjusting the date.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Would you have a... Yeah. What would because the fee is $7.50 per ton for waste.
Madam Chair, I'll be glad to support the bill as a committee bill, but I'd certainly like to understand that before...
Okay. Representative Morgan.
We should probably note, too, that what we're asking here is to have this be given a bill number so that it can be brought to the committee and discussed as a bill at that point.
That's a good comment, Representative Morgan, and the idea is that we would wait on this this bill until we see Idaho C, in other words, and then we could amend that in.
That was just my concern.
Further discussion?
Madam Chair, is this a lot of money? I don't have a concept for how many tons of hazardous waste Oregon has. Would be that be something that Dave Barrows would be able to give us?
Yes, and he would come at a later date. Just from my memory, and I may be wrong, but you can correct me, it seemed to me he was saying they were paying $35 per ton for their costs and significantly lower in Idaho. 15, I believe, was the Idaho rate, but I may be wrong on those exact amounts. It was quite a bit higher. Further discussion? Okay, those are the opinion that LC 1627 should be introduced as a committee bill. We'll say and or vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Hall?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Senator Corey?
Aye.
Senator King?
Aye.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Representative Lee?
Representative
Jones
Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Morgan? Aye. Votes aye. Motion carries. LC 1627 will be introduced as a committee bill. Okay, I'm closing the work session, opening a public hearing on House Bill 2539. Is there anyone here to testify on that bill? Would it be your, this is Representative Lee's bill, and she is excused. Would you prefer to testify now or wait until she is here? Okay. Okay. We'll close the public hearing on 2539. Is there anything else for the good of the committee? Well, thank you very much for your work, and we are adjourned.